You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring, and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
King Slime is a production of iHeart Podcasts and Heirloom Media.
Your Honor, at some point,
Your Honor. I'm sorry, I'm talking, and I don't know why I am being interrupted. I will not stop.
Hey,
I was speaking.
Ms. Lowe,
I'm sorry, I was speaking.
Both y'all can't talk at the same time.
I know, I was speaking, and I expect you allowed to speak when I'm speaking.
Hey, both of you all need to just take it down a notch.
And so, Your Honor, if I may finish, because I was the one speaking before Mr. Weinstein interrupted.
You continually engage in this pattern of behavior, Ms. Love. You don't want to accept my ruling.
Your Honor,
I know you're being an advocate, but at some point, stop. Just stop. I made my ruling. Good, bad, or indifferent to you. You're going to win some, you're going to lose some.
I do accept
okay,
that.
Okay, no,
but
you
Judge,
don't. No,
not.
You don't.
I'm George Chidi.
And I'm Christina Lee.
And this is King Slime. The recap.
There you go. So, hello. Hello, George. How are you doing?
Better now.
I'm so glad to hear that. It's been a mess. We are joined, of course, by executive producer Tommy Andres. Hey, Tommy.
Hey, guys.
And we have a very special guest here to help us dissect whatever the hell happened over the past few days in court. So joining us to not only dissect what's been going on in days 40, 41, and 42, for those who are counting, in addition to the strategy that we may be seeing from both sides of the YSL trial, who I know as Megan the Reporter. Megan Cunniff, you know, started off as a newspaper reporter, and now she's gone independent after she rose to fame covering the Tory Lanez trial over in Los Angeles. Megan, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Before we talk about, like, I guess, like the broader strategy, we need to at least like go through, I guess, what we have seen over the past couple of days. So for those who don't remember, court was essentially out of session for 7 days, but we've been able to see some more testimony from Adrian Bean and some really interesting conversations between prosecution and defense. Maybe I'll take everybody, you know, one step back just to recap what we've supposedly learned from this whole thing, right? So we have witness testimony from police officers where some people are saying there are three people in this red Nissan that did the Free Willy incident into the coin laundromat. Some people say that there were four people in the car. Some people say that there was the driver was a woman who got away and escaped the scene. We have this 911 call for a woman calling on behalf of her neighbor near the Summerdale Apartments who basically said that there was a shooter who walked in to this apartment and said that this guy was named Young Thug or something, or something. Jury doesn't get to hear that part of the call. So all they've heard is that some person may have come into this neighbor's apartment in the moments after the Nissan incident. We've been able to see jail calls from Adrian B, or basically we've got jail calls from Adrian B to his wife and another unidentified male saying, I should have run with Thug because he got away. We have police interviews saying that where Adrian Bean says that Young Thug was there. But now we've got this taped interview where Brian Steele asks Adrian Bean if he was pushed to say that Young Thug was there. This is on top of the fact that the defense has essentially said, you know what, we should remember, this incident was on September 11, 2013. This is more than a decade ago, and Young Thug was never officially charged with all that. Okay, so with all of this in mind, Megan, George, what do we think of all this? Where are we falling if you're a juror on this one particular incident trying to dissect all of this?
So I'll start. We wouldn't hear a word of any of this in a regular murder trial. Like, this is irrelevant because he was never charged. It's prejudicial, in my opinion. And I'm fascinated by the fact that the district attorney's office is introducing this and spending as much time as they are on it in exhaustive detail. Like, if they are going into this much detail on this specific incident, you start asking yourself, well, how much more detail are they going to give for all of the other 100-plus counts that there are on this thing? And how long is this going to take?
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with that. But in terms of this being prejudicial because it wasn't charged, I mean, it's an overt act. Like, if this was a murder case and this was somehow relevant to it, we definitely would be hearing about this. Just because the fact that they didn't charge it originally doesn't mean that they can't come and use it as an overt act in the RICO conspiracy, which they are now. But they just have so many overt acts here that it's just a total waste of time. And I feel like the last... really everything we've heard about in the trial so far the last 4 months has just been, you don't need it for a RICO case. Like, I don't understand why they think they needed such a huge RICO case, like, through all this. And the idea that the jury is going to be able to stay intact through this is just, like, not, I don't think it's feasible. I mean, when you look at the indictment, I mean, they're probably not even like a quarter of the way through it. And we're like, what, five months into trial. I mean, it's crazy to me. It really is just crazy to me how big this case is and the lack of kind of leadership from the judge and kind of whittling it down and managing the trial.
I want to come back to this thing you're saying about, like, keeping the jury intact. And I want to preface this by saying, like, Megan, you've covered a lot of trials and you understand, like, you know, what a long trial could do to a jury. We've lost two jurors so far. Like, the jury's got 16 people in it. Now it's 14. If they get below 12, it's game over. They've got to start again. You're suggesting that as long as this trial is expected to go, you don't expect there to be 12 jurors at the end.
Yeah, I mean, I just can't see for the slow pace that it is and for how incremental they're going here. I mean, they get maybe a couple hours or 3 hours of testimony in a day when they do take testimony. So when you just look at the indictment, the idea that they're ever going to be able to get through it all within, I mean, this could seriously take like a year or two. And yeah, the jurors were screened for a long trial, but you just don't know what's going to go on with their lives. And the idea that they're all just going to stay intact for this. Like, it's a real, I mean, I saw somebody in my Twitter reply say it was just amazing that McAfee has a opponent in the election, but Glanville doesn't. And I'm like, yeah, that, because I mean, the big warning sign initially when I started paying attention to the trial was how he snaps and loses his temper at the attorneys and yells, because that's always a sign of a judge masking management deficiencies of his own. And it just seems like for a big, unusual or unprecedented trial, because I've covered trials that are long, but really the longest trial that I've ever covered is maybe like 2.5 months or something. I mean, this is just crazy to me how long it is and how sporadic the testimony is. Like, it's just, it's crazy.
Well, Glanville's snapping actually just happened. So let's talk about this recent incident here, because I think it speaks to a lot of the relationship between the prosecution and the defense and Glanville's sort of role in mediating between them. Can you walk us through a little bit about what happened?
Yeah, I mean, it's stuff that comes up in any trial, kind of last minute stuff, because they can do all the prep they can, but they can never, you know, just prevent any issue from coming up. But Glanville really has a problem with kind of like taking the bull by the horns. And I guess, God, this was about...
I got you, Megan. So when we first tune into court footage, we have what I've called Adrian Love v. Doug Weinstein v. Judge Glanville, right? So essentially Doug Weinstein, who's representing Diamante Kendrick, otherwise known as rapper Yak Gotti, he was essentially arguing to suppress interviews from 2015 with police, where Diamante Kendrick essentially called for his lawyer. Adrian Love was saying like, hey, but listen, when Diamante Kendrick was going back outside after the fact, after calling for his lawyer to go smoke a cigarette, he proceeded to continue the conversation. And so I guess there was some argument over whether Georgia law said that whatever he said after the fact, even though he called for his lawyer, was still admissible. And so as Adrian Love is speaking in paragraphs about why this is admissible, Doug Weinstein was over it.
Your Honor, at some point, Your Honor.
I'm sorry, I'm talking, and I don't know why I am being interrupted. I will not stop.
Hey,
I was speaking.
Ms. Lowe, y'all got
I'm sorry, I was speaking.
Both y'all can't talk at the same time.
I know, I was speaking, and I'm not allowed to speak when I'm speaking.
Hey, both of you all need to just take it down a notch.
Said that Adrian Love could talk the ears off a donkey.
Your Honor, I apologize for interrupting the state earlier, but the state can talk the ears off a donkey. This continued filibustering has got to stop so that opposing counsel can speak.
And Judge Glanville tried to be like that parent and say, hey, you guys, just get it together. My ruling is my ruling. But as you said, Megan, it only continued to spiral from there. That was literally just within the first couple minutes.
And then the bailiff had to step in.
And I mean, the reason Love pushes back on him so much is because a lot of the times it works. He changes his ruling for her. But she just seemed, I mean, it was just, you know, all the back and forth, the sheriff's deputy stepping in. But also, like, when you see the sheriff's deputy step in, if you really pay attention to what Glanville's doing, he's like looking at his phone at one instant. It's like, what is this judge doing here? Like, he doesn't seem to be really managing this trial and the arguments and the issues and stuff. It's a little concerning.
Yeah, what do you think about Glanville and the pacing of the trial, too? Because we've talked a lot about how the prosecution and defense have sort of contributed to the slow pace of this, but really the judge is the one running the show. So how is he contributing sort of personally to the just sort of how long this is taking?
I mean, the fact that he has a dog in there with him is a warning sign. You know, he has a therapy dog, but a lot of the times you kind of wonder if the dog is dictating some of the breaks. But there's been times, especially recently, he's just been straight up like, you know, oh, I need to take a comfort break. But to me, it's just really unusual from what I'm used to, like this trial in LA that's going on right now. The judge does 8 a.m. to 2 or 2:30 p.m. and he doesn't do a lunch break. He only does 2 10-minute breaks through the whole day. And when he takes the 10-minute break, you can tell he doesn't even really want to do that. And sometimes he'll call it back in 9 minutes. I mean, he doesn't want to waste the jury's time, and he doesn't allow sidebars or anything like that. So that's just like what I'm used to in terms of trial judges. So to see this, I mean, granted, it's Superior Court. He's not an Article III judge, but it just in terms of bringing a huge case like this, in trying to get it tried, it's kind of fascinating to see what a cluster it all is. I mean, just the idea that the jury is ever going to even get this case, first of all. And then when they do, I mean, are they going to even remember like half of this stuff? Like some of the big trials that I cover, you know, there's concern about that. Like, how are you going to remind the witnesses of the testimony in the very beginning? And that's kind of what closing arguments are for. But it's like, what are we going to have, like a 2-week closing argument here? I mean, it's kind of a joke.
Yeah. So you wrote about this, Megan, about Judge Glanville's schedule. So in your writing, you said that he limits testimony to 4 hours per day, which we just talked about. The trial is usually limited to four.
I'm not sure if he limits it, but it's never really been more about 4 hours. But it's not like he has like
not a hard and fast
limit.
Rule.
It's just,
okay.
We never really see more than like 2 or 3 hours.
Between the comfort breaks, the late start time, the long lunch time, it amounts to about like 4 hours.
Four, and then there's only 4 days a week usually because he's you know, supervising judge,
days.
So he's got other things to do. So usually the proceedings are 4 days a week. There have been some Friday proceedings, but not too many. He starts late all the time. Basically, we've all gotten used to that,
yeah.
Right? I mean, usually a half hour to sometimes an hour late. And then these two-hour lunch breaks we talked about. And then there's been these random breaks, too, that just keep popping up where court gets canceled. So it's interesting. And the meanwhile, jurors are getting $25 a day for this, which, as you brought up, Megan, like, you know, not even just keeping people physically in this case for that long, but, I mean, keeping them from just being so damn frustrated and, like,
and
over
broke.
This thing.
Yeah.
And broke. It's like, man. So anyway.
That's something I'm watching here. It's just statistical probability here. You have a lot of jurors who are over 60 years old. Like, what is the likelihood that any one of them gets an illness like COVID that either you shut the whole trial down while they're out for a couple of weeks or you dismiss them? If they have an illness that's more serious than that, then you dismiss them. And how, like, take 14 people, what are the odds that three of them over the course of the year are dismissible mm-hmm. for whatever reason? You know, the longer this plays out, the higher the probability is that you just don't keep a jury pool together.
I mean, that's the thing. It's like in efforts to get a jury that's like representative of our peers, right? You have the folks who are over 60, George, but then on top of that, we're getting additional days off in April specifically because I think Judge Glanville referred to, you know, tending to kids who are going on spring break and things like that. Like, we have real life events that are supposed to happen that cannot possibly be accommodated for a trial that Brian Steele has joked, but also maybe not joked, is supposed to last until Super Bowl 2025, if Megan's estimation is correct. So,
yeah. I mean, what happens when we get to summer if these people have kids? Like, you know,
well, and I think the trial could easily be like changed. Like, I mean, in the article I wrote, like Bruce Harvey talked about how he thinks there's going to be a change in approach here pretty soon and that they could be done by August or September. But to be done by August or September, they would have to really, really, really change their approach. And just looking into the background, like the politics of the DA's office and what happened with this case, how the prosecution team was like replaced after the indictment was already secured, I don't think the prosecutors are going to really feel comfortable changing the case very much like that. You know, they came into the case late. This is the case. And this is how they're doing it. Because I was hesitant because some people are saying, oh, the prosecutors are mediocre. And I don't think they're mediocre. Like, I think Simone Hilton is good. I mean, she's president of like a National Prosecutors Association or something mm-hmm. this year. But you can tell she's very experienced with the types of cases that are the overt acts, like a carjacking trial, a home burglary trial, an armed robbery trial. Same with Christian Adkins. And like DA Love is probably kind of like a legend in the DA's office for some of the cases that she's won, like the murder case. The robbery cases and stuff. But in terms of like a big conspiracy case, it's just like they don't know what they're doing in terms of how they put it together. But to really blame them when you hear the background of they weren't even the original prosecution team, you can just look at all the politics in the DA's office, especially right now, and feel like the prosecutors themselves probably feel like they are kind of stuck because they probably do see that they could look at the indictment and take out a bunch of stuff that doesn't need to be in there, but they don't want to send an indictment back to the jury room that has a bunch of stuff in there that they didn't cover. So it's just like kind of this cluster that it's like a combination of the politics of the DA's office and then just the oversize of the case that's created this like conundrum for the prosecutorial team. You wonder if they even really feel like they can make any changes right now.
One of the things I'd like you to do is put this RICO in context with other RICO cases that you've looked at. Like, what does normal look like so that we can sort of reset our expectations here?
I mean, I covered a federal RICO case in Orange County involving the Mongols Motorcycle Club. And I was just kind of surprised to learn about how often the state RICO charge in Georgia is used. I mean, against the court reporters a few years ago and things like that. It seems like it's kind of more of a looser application in Georgia state law. But at least the Mongols Motorcycle Club case was all about a conspiracy with the gang. Like one good example, and I cited this in my article, was that a couple of the overt acts or the supporting acts there was a RICO conspiracy charge, and then there was actually just a violation of RICO. Not just they conspired to violate RICO, they did violate RICO. And some of the overt acts were drug possession, like methamphetamine and cocaine possession. But they actually stipulated, the defense and the prosecution stipulated to the fact that those drugs were those drugs. So they brought the drugs into the courtroom and everything, but they didn't have somebody from like a crime lab get up and testify about the testing process for the drugs. Because the legal question wasn't drug possession or whether the drugs actually existed. It's whether they were part of the club, whether they related to the club and not just the individual members who'd been arrested with that. So the trial was just a lot shorter. It was like 5 days a week and, you know, 8:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. All this testimony was just better managed. So you got it all in tighter. But also just in terms of how prosecutors approached it, it was a much more conspiracy case instead of let's have a bunch of mini trials about all the overt acts, which I feel like that's what this is.
So is that how you'd sum up the prosecution's strategy, as having these sort of mini trials about the overt acts?
Yeah, and I'm not sure if we should call it a strategy, or it's just kind of an accidental way of how they're doing it, because none of them have ever really, you know, have they done a big conspiracy case like this? And then, like I said, the kind of last minute change of the prosecutors. And the way these cases work is they just split up the witnesses, and, you know, one prosecutor has a group of witnesses that he takes care of, and the other prosecutors have their groups of witnesses. So you just wonder how much talk there is about actually proving a conspiracy here, because I think Adrienne Love tried to do that in writing her opening. She tried to write the, you know, theme about the wolf pack and stuff, but you just haven't seen that play out through their witnesses, and they're completely screwing themselves by having way too big of a case. Yeah. Like, I mean, they're just, yeah.
Yeah, the in furtherance of a gang is the thing we always talk about, the phrase that comes up here all the time. And we've just, I don't know, from our perches, we've seen, I'm curious for yours, it sounds like you're similar. Like we haven't really seen that proven or even really alluded to as much as I would have thought so far in this trial, you know?
You mean besides the super slimy cover art?
Yeah. And I almost feel like, I mean, gosh, we have heard so many witnesses about this red Nissan crashing into a laundromat. It's like, okay, you know, I mean, seriously, I mean, how many have there been? Like 15? I mean, it almost seems like it would be overkill if it was just a trial about, you know, a rioting charge or something that was related to this melee. It would just be overkill here. But for this to just be three overt acts for 191 of a RICO conspiracy, you know, it's just way too much.
You know, what's really interesting is that we're still not going to hear the end of Adrienne Biehn as of this recording. Like, he is on the stand right now, sounding very, very sick of being on there, by the way.
Everybody will keep asking me questions. I'm going to move on with my life, man. I ain't got time for these games. Y'all done assassinated me, man. It's about time for some actions now.
Do you remember?
I'm all on all these blogs, all these channels, my face all over the news, everything like that. Keep on asking questions. I'm telling you, I don't recall.
He is over it. He is over saying, no, sir, no, ma'am, I don't recall whatever the paper says. So he is still on the stand at this moment. And then in the meantime, yesterday, so on Thursday, as the jury was essentially waiting in the courthouse to enter the courtroom, Adrienne Love and Brian Seal are also debating over this hospital statement that may or may not exist, right? So basically what the jury has heard so far is Adrienne Love reading from a police statement that Adrienne Biehn gave to Detective Quinn in the days after the incident. But then, as Brian Seal posits, there has to be another statement taken when Adrienne Biehn was at Grady Hospital, basically refuting his original statement to Detective Quinn and saying, like, you know, they, the, in which, like, they tried to pin Young Thug specifically, not only being the car, but being in the driver. And so there's this whole back and forth about who supposedly is more robbed over this hospital statement existing, not existing, somehow not materializing. And then this turns into like a whole shouting match over like, who is being more unethical? Who is being more unjust, like in the court of law?
You are saying to the court that you have a belief that there is another statement out there. There's not.
How could you say that?
Because it hasn't been brought up. If it gets brought up, then we'll correct it at that point in time. But right now, I'm going to direct you not to inquire that line. You don't have a basis to do so.
Not true.
Well, go ahead and make a statement and see what happens.
Your Honor, listen.
Go ahead and make the statement in contravention to what I've just told you. And I'm telling you that you will have some problems in front of me.
I don't know what to make of all this, you guys. Like, it really felt produced by Andy Cohen. It felt like a reunion episode of a Bravo show, but it was completely unsatisfying.
It's a little thing called discovery. Her phone number appears in Mark's phone record. You will have to appear in court. Here is your subpoena.
And I just couldn't believe what I was witnessing, where like one side is accusing the other of essentially fabricating evidence. And meanwhile, you have Brian Steele over here that's being like, Adrian Love is not my boss.
It is obscene. Miss Love is not my boss. I owe nothing except to the law and Mr. Williams. And that's where I am.
Yeah, I thought Glanville said something to Adrian Love that I thought was interesting, where he was telling her to stop and calm down. And he was like, I know you're being an advocate.
You continually engage in this pattern of behavior, Miss Love. You don't want to accept my ruling.
Your Honor,
I know you're being an advocate, but at some point, stop. Just stop.
Which is true. She is an advocate. She's an advocate for the state, the laws, the people of Georgia. But also, it just reminded me of another case I'm covering. There was a magistrate judge in a transcript said something that the roles of the prosecutor and the defense are different. Like, it's the defense's job to actually just throw anything at the wall to try to get it to stick, to advocate for their client. I mean, that's kind of a glib way to sum it up. But it really is, you know, the defense should be putting any argument out there that they can. But to say that the prosecutor should just be throwing spaghetti at the wall, it's like the prosecutors are held to a little bit of a higher standard in that they need to have a clear goal and argument there. So just the way she's so, her accusation against Steele, I think, did kind of cross the line, especially about, I mean, cross the line in terms of what is the line, but in terms of accusing him of, you know, he's the one who planted, who mentioned the hospital to Adrian when actually they play the tape back and Adrian is the one who mentioned the hospital. It's just, you'd think that the prosecutors need to be a little more careful and know their evidence a little bit better than what they're doing there. And then also, in terms of the professionalism of it, because he said something about, you know, the rants of DA Love, which maybe was a little unprofessional on his part. He doesn't need to like quite use that term. But then she turns around and says, you know, he needs to stop insulting me. And then while we're on it, you know, he gets up there and it's just hysterical. And it's like, it's just that kind of hyperbolic talk that she turns around and insults him too, where it's just, and one big problem is there's no judge up there actually just regulating on all of this, because in the end, all this stuff just starts at the top and trickles down.
All right, we're going to take a break. We'll be right back after this.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
Now I'd like to introduce you to Meaningful Beauty, the famed skincare brand created by iconic supermodel Cindy Crawford. It's her secret to absolutely gorgeous skin. Meaningful Beauty makes powerful and effective skincare simple, and it's loved by millions of women. It's formulated for all ages and all skin tones and types, and it's designed to work as a complete skincare system, leaving your skin feeling soft, smooth, and nourished. I recommend starting with Cindy's full regimen, which contains all five of her best-selling products, including the amazing youth-activating Melon Serum. This next generation serum has the power of melon leaf stem cell technology. It's melon leaf stem cells encapsulated for freshness and released onto the skin to support a visible reduction in the appearance of wrinkles. With thousands of glowing five-star reviews, why not give it a try? Subscribe today and you can get the amazing Meaningful Beauty System for just $49.95. That includes our introductory five-piece system, free gifts, free shipping, and a 60-day money-back guarantee. All that available at MeaningfulBeauty.com.
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
Rain or shine, every day is a great day for fishing, right? You got rain gear, but you can't overlook sunny day gear. A Columbia PFG Solar Stream Elite hoodie has you covered on the sunniest days. Like, literally. I mean, who wouldn't trade a sunburn for a trophy fish? But why do it if you don't have to? Especially when this Solar Stream Elite hoodie is built with broad-spectrum UV protection. We're talking UPF 50. And it has airflow so you don't overheat. And what's the alternative? Putting down the rod every half hour so you can slather on some sunscreen. Seems like an easy choice to me. Columbia PFG has you covered with their Castback TC shoe. Its OmniMax cushioning and traction system helps if you're on your feet a lot, say, fighting a fish. Not to mention keeping you sure-footed on a wet rocking boat. So if you're going to be spending long days out on the water, and I sincerely hope that you will be, head over to Columbia.com/PFG and shop all their performance fishing gear.
And we're back.
So we had some other interesting news pop in this week, which was this Supreme Court decision on lyrics. So, George, this is in Georgia. Georgia right. Supreme Court decision on lyrics that may or may not impact this case. But let's talk about if it will and what it is. So why don't you tell us what it is, George?
So let's start with this. It's not actually about lyrics. Once you drill into the actual case, like, just so everybody understands, the Georgia Supreme Court set aside a murder conviction about a week ago because prosecutors had shown a 33-second clip of the defendant in a music video where the defendant is waving a gun around, and that they viewed that as prejudicial. And that might be why I was describing this other stuff as prejudicial. That idea is in my head right now as I was reading the ruling. The fellow who was convicted and whose conviction was set aside was the road manager for a rapper named No Cap, who's out of Mobile. I'm going to call him a mumble rapper because the ruling says that the video itself, like, was unintelligible.
That should be the ultimate barometer for whether someone is a mumble rapper or what. Because I can understand Future. I've lived in Atlanta all these years. But if the court of law says...
Yeah, we can't understand your lyrics. We don't think they matter.
Right. Correct.
And that's my point. Like, it's not actually about the lyrics. The lyrics didn't come up in the trial at all. It was a video with a bunch of guys with guns, and he was one of them. And he was pointing the gun and waving it at the camera and whatnot. And essentially, the prosecutors showed this video, not like they made an argument saying this is important evidence because it shows that he was associated with the guy who was at the concert before the shooting and that they knew each other and that we have reason to understand why he was present at the time and all the rest of this, except that all of that had effectively been stipulated by the defense. Mm-hmm. So all that was left was using this video to show jurors to say, this is a bad person and you should probably put him in jail, which is the definition of prejudicial. Like, in fact, like the closing arguments in the case were essentially saying, we have a gun violence problem in our community and you can do something about it. And this is what it looks like, you know, referencing the video. And that was enough. That was enough for the Supreme Court to go, get out of here. I bring all of this up because we've had some videos in this case.
So many.
I mean, of the 191 overt acts, 60 relate to song lyrics or social media posting. So that's both of those things together. But we had several emails from lawyers that sent us emails that were like, hey, keep an eye on this because this might impact the Young Thug trial. So, Megan, I'm actually curious from you, do you think a ruling like that at the Georgia Supreme Court could have an impact on this trial, on the YSL trial?
Not on the trial as it's going on, but if there's ever a judgment on this that gets appealed to the Court of Appeal, of course, a ruling like that would be factored into the case law. But the idea that it's going to change the way prosecutors are operating right now, not at all. It's not going to affect the trial. It could affect the case later on through the appellate process.
Interesting.
I've been saying that all along. I don't think Brian Steele, looking at the evidence that we expect to emerge eventually, I think he is assuming that there are going to be convictions in the case and that he is preserving and preparing for the appeal. Like, that's going to get all of it thrown out.
He'd be committing malpractice if he wasn't doing that. But like Bruce Harvey, you can see where he's always setting the record for some kind of appeal on interesting conspiracy theories. Because, it's common to have, you know, a bunch of co-defendants on trial, and then maybe some of them aren't on trial at that time, but their stuff is being mentioned. But this is just like so extreme what's going on. But you can definitely tell that Bruce Harvey, who's by far the most experienced criminal defense attorney in that courtroom, is setting up some kind of appeal or some kind of grounds for an appeal on the conspiracy, you know, how his client keeps getting kind of wrapped into these cross-examinations and this information coming out through cross-examination when Bruce Harvey hasn't done anything himself.
I mean, we've talked a lot about how it's the defense's job to, throw spaghetti on the wall. And we've talked about this preparation, you know, for a potential appeal. Is there anything else to remark upon as far as like defense strategy? Like, is there any tactics that have stood out in the past however many months in trial?
I mean, one thing, the prosecutors set the case, so the defense kind of has to play into that. But I also feel like the defense is almost making too much a mistake sometimes by focusing way too in on the weeds and kind of playing into this game of like, let's make every overt act a trial in itself. But also that I think that aids the defense more than it does the prosecution for sure.
So it's not just me.
In the end, it's hard to assess things because trials are all about the big picture. And, mm-hmm. and I think Bruce Harvey more than anyone understands that, but he was really taking issue with some of the doors that had been opened, like in the cross-examination of Tick, those messages about the web that they were able to get in, and they ruled it was because the cross-examination of Tick opened up the door for it, because Brian Steele was, you know, implying that, you know, Tick and Thug had kind of parted ways and weren't having much contact. And just the way Bruce Harvey was arguing against that, you can tell he understands the significance of that.
And that's why I'm objecting. I think it's disingenuous now to say, oh, boy, we think this is 801D2E. It's part of the conspiracy. It's not part of the conspiracy. It's Mr. Nichols, who was in jail at the time these things happened.
And it was a good example of how, I mean, trials are about the details, but they're also about the big picture. And you can get so focused on the details that you lose track of the big picture. And then people watching at home can just be like, oh, that was such a great cross-examination. You know, he really nailed Tick, but they don't understand the big picture of what's coming and all the evidence and how, you know, 3 months later, the prosecutors might bring in a bunch of testimony and evidence that actually makes that cross-examination look kind of silly. But the problem is the trial is just so big and there's so many gaps in the testimony that it's like, who even has the memory for all this stuff, you know?
Yeah. As you've been covering the trial, Megan, like for those who haven't gone to Megan's YouTube page, first of all, she's like posting up the streams. She's posting like really great clips from court, whether that's like these hearings or from actual testimony. And she's even organizing them into specific categories just so that folks can get a sense of like what broader themes are sort of coming up. I'm curious to know from you, like, if there's been any particular moment or even a clip, if you will, of the trial that has stood out, whether it, I hate to call it a favorite, but like almost like speaks to the absurdity of everything you're talking about.
I was a fan of the cross-examination of Tick. I mean, I think I did a story a while back that just kind of summed up my coverage. And the one clip that I included was like a 13-minute segment of Brian Steele talking to him about getting kicked off the rodeo tour, like, you know, all these years ago because he was committing crimes, and just kind of the way Steele takes him through that.
And you remember there came a time that you and others were accused of wrongdoing on that tour.
Yeah.
And that is committing crime, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And do you remember Jeffrey Williams repaying any victim of those crimes?
But I ain't commit no crime, though.
Okay. Do you remember him? I'm not saying you did, but you were accused. Somebody thought you did, right?
Yeah.
True?
True.
And then, of course, there's Glanville sustains some dumb objections like in the middle of it and like kind of wrecks it. And then after a few minutes, like just calls a comfort break, like, oh, let's put a pin in it for the day. So it really kind of has like everything in it from the trial. But I mean, Steele is a really skilled trial lawyer. And I thought it was like an interesting just the way he's kind of, you know, questioning Tick there. So that's the one I would go for. But I mean, everything, like, that's just, as somebody who loves, you know, trials and amused to just watching stuff in court with no access to cameras, to actually have an interesting trial or one that I'm into and have camera access to all this, I'm like, there's so much to do. And I feel like the public gets way, way more out of that than, I mean, there's so many commentary videos on YouTube and everybody trying to tell you what you're supposed to think about the testimony. And I mean, you see it in the political world too. You know, the second the political speeches started, all the operatives get on Twitter and start trying to spin it one way or the other. And we have the same thing going on with the Young Thug trial where it's like, oh, this guy was destroyed on the stand. And it's like, I would much rather just put clips up there and let people like watch it themselves and give some analysis about like why the lawyers are asking what they're asking for. But everybody always asks me like who's winning or do you think, you know, and I frankly don't know how to answer.
Well, it's kind of weird to say. I mean, like, never mind the question of neutral reportage, like the idea that we're calling this like color commentators.
Like a fight.
Is just, it's a little, like, this is supposed to be a court. What are we doing? You know, I am curious
about
I'd like you to just, who are the people that are watching you? Who are the people that you see that are most intensely interested in the kinds of cases that you cover?
You mean besides me?
Yeah.
I mean, I cover so many different cases. Like right now, I mean, and I have been kind of reminded, and I had a few people comment on my recent coverage of a federal judge in Orange County who's dismissing charges against these neo-Nazis and releasing them. And there's all this stuff. And then also the FBI and ex-FBI informant who was charged with lying about the Bidens. That's an LA case. And I've done a couple. I did a story on that, kind of introducing the judge who was assigned. And I had a few people comment that my skills and knowledge as like a legal affairs reporter are so much better spent on stuff like that than just writing about the drama in the music industry. So that was kind of a good, I mean, I'm kind of at a, you know, trying to figure out what do I cover and what do I not, and what do I prioritize and what do I not. But I think my mailing list is kind of focused on, you know, LA federal courts coverage, because it's a lot of lawyers and a lot of, you know, judges too in LA who read about, you know, the federal courts coverage. And then also there's so much political stuff. Like there's a big LA public corruption saga that's the trial that's going on right now. So I have a big readership base on that. But then I also have a lot of people, you know, from the hip hop industry who remember me from Tory Lanez and want coverage of that. But I just, as a journalist, have to kind of find, you know, frankly, a good balance for me. And then also, you know, what's going to make me a living? Because people want me to just do stuff for free. And, you know, it's like, look, I need to figure out how I'm going to like survive in this world and maybe eventually buy a house and, you know, maybe eventually retire or something. So I kind of feel like the hip hop stuff and like the Young Thug stuff is really best preserved for YouTube. It's perfect for YouTube and TikTok. But the idea that I should be writing articles about this for my mailing list, when my mailing list is lawyers who could take one look at this case and know that it's kind of a joke. Like the story has to be like the last story I did, I think was good because it kind of captured that. But to just be writing articles about, you know, hey, here's what a witness said about the red Nissan, you know, crashing into the laundromat. It's like, no. So, you know, it's just kind of trying to figure that out.
You know, I understand that.
I was going to say whether you relate, George.
Yeah, I've been wrestling with this myself. So, I mean, and there are a lot of folks who understand that I'm a political journalist, generally speaking, and that I started to look at this case because I was looking at the political impact of crime in Atlanta. One thing leads to another. And, you know, a year and a half later, I'm looking at 2 weeks of testimony about a red Nissan and questioning my life choices. Not that, I mean, I want listeners, hear me, like, I love you and I want to serve you. But I'm also like going, like, I keep wanting to come back to the fundamental question that, like, the King Slime podcast started over it. All of this coverage started over, which is like, what is the impact of this trial? And this, what can we see as we're looking at this that speaks to the bigger, broader picture about what criminal justice looks like in Atlanta and in the United States? And where does hip hop intersect with, you know, this policy question around violent crime, and how should we be addressing this issue of like violent lyrics in music and its nexus to, you know, street crime and all the rest of this? Like 2 weeks of Nissan.
Spectacle. Yeah. It's spotlight a lot. For sure.
I think it's scary. It's scary that they're being held without bail for this. And then, I mean, like we've said, we think it's kind of just destined to end with the jury just kind of dissolving. You know, they're not going to be able to keep the jury together. But the idea that would be like a good thing for Young Thug, because if that happens, they're just going to retry him again. I mean, it would be kind of crazy to have that happen. But the idea that if that does happen, the prosecutors are just going to throw up their hands and be like, okay, well, case dismissed. Of course not. Like, they're just going to try to retry him again. So it's like, okay, so what are we doing here? Is there ever going to be like some kind of like moment of reckoning for this case or the prosecutor's office? You know, I don't know.
Yeah. We've talked about that several times about how a mistrial is actually a nightmare for everyone. Like nobody wants a mistrial because after this long, I mean, good God, the having to repeat this whole process again is a pretty terrible punishment that no one should be given. But you know, that's an interesting point too, because we just talked about that Georgia Supreme Court ruling where that verdict was overturned, but that guy doesn't get away. Like, they can retry him if they choose to. We don't know whether they're going to make that choice or not yet, but they could choose to retry him, which is, you know, it is. It's like, even if you even winning could be a loss in some ways.
Yes.
and they're likely to. That's Houston County. Like, part of the reason this went down the way it did was because that particular court and that district attorney are that is the guy they want to prosecute.
Yeah.
So they'll come back to it.
All right. More from King Slime after this.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
Now I'd like to introduce you to Meaningful Beauty, the famed skincare brand created by iconic supermodel Cindy Crawford. It's her secret to absolutely gorgeous skin. Meaningful Beauty makes powerful and effective skincare simple, and it's loved by millions of women. It's formulated for all ages and all skin tones and types, and it's designed to work as a complete skincare system, leaving your skin feeling soft, smooth, and nourished. I recommend starting with Cindy's full regimen, which contains all five of her best-selling products, including the amazing youth-activating Melon Serum. This next generation serum has the power of melon leaf stem cell technology. It's melon leaf stem cells encapsulated for freshness and released onto the skin to support a visible reduction in the appearance of wrinkles. With thousands of glowing five-star reviews, why not give it a try? Subscribe today and you can get the amazing Meaningful Beauty System for just $49.95. That includes our introductory five-piece system, free gifts, free shipping, and a 60-day money-back guarantee. All of that available at MeaningfulBeauty.com.
Rain or shine, every day is a great day for fishing, right? You got rain gear, but you can't overlook sunny day gear. A Columbia PFG Solar Stream Elite hoodie has you covered on the sunniest days. Like, literally. I mean, who wouldn't trade a sunburn for a trophy fish? But why do it if you don't have to? Especially when this Solar Stream Elite hoodie is built with broad-spectrum UV protection. We're talking UPF 50. And it has airflow so you don't overheat. And what's the alternative? Putting down the rod every half hour so you can slather on some sunscreen. Seems like an easy choice to me. Columbia PFG has you covered with their Castback TC shoe. Its OmniMax cushioning and traction system helps if you're on your feet a lot, say, fighting a fish. Not to mention keeping you sure-footed on a wet rocking boat. So if you're going to be spending long days out on the water, and I sincerely hope that you will be, head over to Columbia.com/PFG and shop all their performance fishing gear.
Hi, I'm Giancarlo Esposito, and I'm here to introduce you to my character, Gray Parrish, from my new series, Parrish.
Yeah, I can drive.
My character was a getaway driver.
Yeah!
I'm retired from life, you know that.
His business is failing, his house is going up for sale. He is the everyman.
Tell me about this driver job.
We got a lot of action in this show. We have moments of real danger, and we want to feel as if anything could happen. Gray is invited to drive for this man. He's invited to make money, and he quickly realizes this is not the right thing to do.
I did what you told me to.
And he's in a world over his head.
Now, let's go!
He will try to do what's right and seek justice.
Parrish, all new Sundays at 9 on AMC and stream on AMC Plus.
This is King Slide. We're back.
So I'm curious, Megan, about your sort of broader thoughts on what this trial says about the criminal justice system in America and maybe about hip hop specifically, since you have some of that experience as well. And I guess I'm trying to get away from let's move away from how long it's taking and the bogged down stuff and more of the big questions that George was just talking about. Anything strike you?
I think it's just it seems like a local political Atlanta story, just the choice for them to go after Young Thug and the fact that he's local there and that all these crimes are local. Because when you read through the indictment and see all the, you know, serious stuff, because I think a lot of people think that, you know, all this stuff just happened so long ago. But there was a murder that happened just in 2022 that I think just kind of underscores it's so crazy that they're focusing on all this old stuff. But it frankly just seems like a local criminal case involving somebody who's famous. Mm. I'm trying to think of like some really profound thing to say about what this says about criminal justice and hip hop. And I think that's a guy and, you know, alleged gang members who have been well known in Atlanta for a while. And finally there was like a political groundswell in the prosecutor's office to charge him. Like, I'm not sure. Cause I mean, the American criminal justice system is just so huge and vast. And in the end, it all just comes down to individual people. And it kind of comes down to politics. So it's like what they say about all politics is local, you know?
I agree with you in part and disagree with you in part, because you're right. Like, every case is individual. Like, there's people who commit a murder on the street are not thinking about grand questions of criminal justice in the United States. They're doing whatever they're going to do. And it is, in fact, like, it's not just all politics are local. All murder pretty much is local, too. What I'm thinking about is how, like the YMW Melly. Yeah, Melly case in Florida, or this recent convictions in New York of like the Gorilla Gang guy, and all the stuff that's been going on in Chicago with Drill and the Memphis stuff that's been going on recently. What I'm looking for are signs that prosecutors around the country are looking at this case and in sort of trepidation of saying, all right, if I want to roll up a street gang in Louisiana, in New Orleans, that's got a lot of ties to the music industry, is this what I'm going to go through in order to get at it? Like, setting aside the question of guilt or innocence of Young Thug or the trial itself, the process here looks nuts. And I'm imagining other district attorneys looking at this going, how do I not do that if I'm going to try to get at any of this?
I mean, the thing is that, like, going into the YSL trial, there was so much news coverage about the historic precedents, you know, about lyrics and even just the image of rap being used in trial. So it's not necessarily a new technique. I think what is new is precisely the reason why it's fitting for Megan to be on here today, is that it's to a national audience. Even all of these particularly local cases, King Slime is emblematic of how we've had to talk about Atlanta politics, how politics being local on the national stage, specifically because hip hop is the music of the moment. And so that's the conundrum that people will find themselves in. And I wonder if these courts are going to be ready for that sort of scrutiny. So maybe, yes, they're looking to them as a tactic, but like when it comes to a jury being able to process what is being presented in court alone, I feel like that's going to get even more challenging as time wears on because of how everything is being documented on social media and thrown up for everybody to see. It's going to get harder and harder to ignore the peanut gallery, the commentary, all that kind of stuff, especially when hip hop's audience is very much online.
I don't know. All I know is the DAs that I know of, like the DA in LA, Gascon, he would never bring a case like this. LA would never bring a case like this. The Orange County DA, Orange County, California, is more conservative and would be like prone to maybe bring a case like this if they had anyone to bring a case like this against. I mean, there's no kind of like hip hop or, you know, kind of rap gang problem in Orange County. But if there was the idea that he would think that he needs to take any advice from some LA, from some DA over on the other side of the country, like no way. Like maybe there's some, you know, it's probably more local, like Southern, like you were saying, like New Orleans, you know, Florida.
Memphis.
I mean, if those people are kind of looking at this case as some kind of test for it, but I wouldn't see any kind of DAs on like the West Coast kind of that interested in this.
That's interesting.
So, Megan, I'm curious, maybe last question here. So, obviously, covering this remotely, you know, you were in the courtroom for the Tory Lanez trial. So, how is it different, you know, dialing in remotely and covering this on your computer instead of being in person?
To me, it's just great because, like, the trial is just, I mean, I couldn't if I was over that. I mean, it's just, it's a local trial about, you know, county cops testifying about, you know, an armed robbery or something, and the way it's so slow and stuff, I'm just thank God for the live stream. You know, it's just not the kind of case that the trial that I'm used to covering in terms of like how it's managed, and I couldn't last a day over there with all their breaks and everything. So I mean, you do kind of miss like the, you know, if there's people in the gallery and stuff. But this trial is just so different in terms of how big and sprawling it is that, you know, trials have like feels to it. You can kind of get a vibe from the courtroom, but I'm not sure if this one would really have that.
No vibe. Wow. Okay. Well, thank you so much, Megan, for joining us. Of course, we can find you over on YouTube, Instagram, at TikTok, at Megan Cuniff. You've also got your Substack, which you mentioned, legalsaffairsandtrials.com. Thank you so much for joining us. King Slime is a production of iHeart Podcasts and Heirloom Media.
It's written and produced by George Chidi, Christina Lee, and Tommy Andres.
Mixing, sound design, and original music by Evan Tyer and Taylor Chacoin.
The executive producer and editor is Tommy Andres.
Our theme music is by Dunn Deal.
For more shows from iHeart Podcasts, visit the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
This episode brought to you by 20th Century Studios' Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Director Wes Ball breathes new life into the epic franchise. As a ruthless king attempts to build his empire at the expense of the remaining human race, a young ape begins a journey to fight for a future for apes and humans alike. Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Enter the kingdom in IMAX on May 10th and theaters everywhere. Get tickets now.
Hey guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Viking. Committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, cultural enrichment, and all-inclusive fares. Discover more at viking.com.